Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Hello and happy Friday. I'm Zach Crouch, host of the Recovery Radio podcast, your internet radio destination for addiction and recovery resources that save lives and empower families. Do you know someone addicted to drugs or alcohol? Perhaps you've been struggling personally and are looking for resources and expert guidance. Recovery Radio is definitely here to help. We are dedicated to providing you with the necessary tools to inspire a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, or loved one to take that first step on their road to recovery. Our guest today is James Hadlock. James is a former drug-addicted entrepreneur and multimillionaire turned purpose-driven family man, trainer, and coach who speaks nationally on the transformative power of meaningful connection and how it impacts business, family, and personal success. He's the founder of Blue Novus, a human development company with over 25 years of leadership, consulting, and entrepreneurial experience, as well as more than 10 years drug and alcohol free. James's view on connection and success are both thought-provoking and inspiring. James has worked with professional athletes, business executives, families, as well as the addiction recovery industry. Just like to say thank you, James, for joining us today on our podcast, and we're very gracious to have you on as a guest.
Hey, thank you, Zach. Excited to be here with you.
Yeah, likewise, man. And where do I find you today? Are you out in Utah, or where are you?
Yeah, if you've heard of Park City, Utah, which is where famous Sundance Film Festival is, and where the Olympics were held back in 2002, it's a ski resort town, so I live up here in the snowy mountains of Utah.
It's a beautiful area. Yeah, there's some halfway decent skiing up there, too.
Yeah, very much so.
Gosh, man. Well, good stuff, man. The title of our show today is, it's called The Fears Families Experience When Addiction is Present, and also What to Do. So, you know, with that title, I'm just going to jump into a couple questions here. So some addicts really have a hard time realizing that they need treatment. I experience that all the time with the phone calls that I get from family members, from professionals. They just don't know what to do. What advice would you give to those people who are unaware that they actually need treatment?
So are you're asking me what advice I would give the actual person that's struggling with addiction or the loved one?
Let's start with the person who needs treatment, and then also for the people that are around that person.
Yeah, so that's a could be a very complicated question to answer, and I think a lot of people be confused on really where to even start with that. In my experience, attempting to tell someone who is struggling with addiction that they need help doesn't go very well. In fact, I go back to when I myself was struggling. You know, deep down, I already knew that I needed some help or some support, but because of the place I was in, the pride and even just feeling ashamed and guilty about it, to have somebody else start to tell me almost always felt like a lecture, even if it came from a place of compassion. And sure. So I would say attempting to try to convince them or tell them that they need that help, at least in the beginning of the conversation, is ill-advised.
Okay. Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You're talking to a guy who is also knee-deep in the recovery process as well. And you couldn't, you know, for lack of a better word, tell me a damn thing, you know. It really, James, personally, for me, wasn't until, and it's, I think each person's different, they hit their own bottom, so to speak, or there's, you know, a certain moment of clarity or whatever it might, you know, we might call it. But for me, I remember very well, vividly, I was in my dad's home, in my parents' home. There's, you know, they're still together. And I had borrowed an Eric Clapton CD from him, right? And this was back, you know, when we listened to CDs, which I think, you know, I don't know if we do anymore. But anyway, I had borrowed an Eric Clapton CD from him. And I was either drunk, high, or hungover, or all three. And I had probably borrowed it for a month or two, you know. And he just simply asked for the CD back, you know. It wasn't an aggressive way. It was just simply, hey, where's my CD? I need it back. Thanks. And I turned to him and I said, F you, okay? And for me, I was like, what the hell did I just, what happened? You know, what was that about, you know? And at the time, I felt pressured, I'm sure, and dignified and, you know, whatever, you know, myriad of reasons I said that. But for me, that was the first time that I had said something like that in his house. And he told me, well, F you too, get out of my house and don't ever come back here again. And I knew right then and there, man, that this was not the person that I wanted to become, you know. And that was the person that I was becoming. And I didn't know any other way to get out of that, you know, sort of stranglehold that addiction really had me in. So, you know, whatever it takes, right? but convincing me that I had a problem, to your point, wasn't going to work.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we tend to forget, being on the other side or being someone who is trying to support someone who's struggling or a family member that's watching the self-destruction of somebody is we tend to forget that they are literally in survival mode.
Right.
And if you go into the science of that, fairly well known today is a theory called polyvagal theory. So if you want to get into a little bit of the science, which I love sharing,
yes.
I'll talk in very plain speak. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not a therapist. But I have been a researcher for the last decade around some of these concepts and ideas. And this idea of polyvagal theory really speaks to what's going on with an individual who's struggling with addiction and who is in this survival mode. And as you and I both know, Zach, and our listeners have experienced firsthand, you know, if you could imagine yourself just, you know, sitting in a coffee shop and just out of the blue, a raging bull bursts through the window, what happens to us physically? What happens to us, you know, physiologically? We go into what's called survival mode, right? And
right.
When that happens with our autonomic nervous system, there are some key things that happen without even our knowledge. And that is, you know, our heartbeat speeds up. We become very heightened in our awareness of that moment and that situation. And we think of only one thing. We don't go into ho-humming. We literally go into a reactionary state where we're going to run, right? We're going to run, or we're going to maybe go after the bull, which is very unlikely, but it's part of that fight or flight. And then that third one, which is an extreme case, is where we just freeze. We can't move at all. It's
right.
That deer in headlights. Right? So that's what happens when we're in survival mode. And one of the things that just became very apparent to me when I found recovery a little over a decade ago was, you know, I was operating from that place most of my life. And
sure.
And it showed up in different ways. But in that place, it's very hard to think clearly. Other than just that one piece, which is I need to survive, I need to get out of the risk.
Right.
And so when you talk about what you were going through with your dad, you know, we become super defensive when we're in that fight or flight. And now kind of circling back to this, the science of polyvagal theory, one of the things that a neuroscientist by the name of Dr. Porges discovered is that we have no control over some of these physiological responses that happen to us when we're in survival mode, when all of a sudden we face a terror or something that's scary, like a bull coming through the coffee shop.
Yeah, because kind of to your point, this is a very old piece of our brain, right? This is a very evolution
brain.
Hasn't caught up with that old part of our brain, like the part that is able to think, and make rational decisions, right?
That's right. So it's part of the lizard brain, and I know a lot of people have probably heard that terminology before. And what Dr. Portis was starting to look at is, if in this survival mode state that we're in, if we literally have no control over certain physiological responses, then he started to look at the opposite of survival mode. And he wondered, are there some responses that we have no control over when you're at the other end of the spectrum? In other words, what happens when we feel ultimately safe? What happens when we feel like we're not threatened? Is there some things that start to happen in our, in our biology? And what he has discovered, and this is something he started doing back in the late 80s, early 90s. So it's been around a while, and he was working with patients in the with post-traumatic stress disorders.
Okay.
So primarily with veterans. And what he discovered, quite relevant not only to loved ones who have someone who's struggling with addiction, but anyone who's in the addiction recovery space, what he discovered was fascinating, that when people felt safe, they became more creative, they were more open to suggestion, they were in a state to learn faster, and they started to connect and had more of an ability to connect with other people when they were in that place of safety. So as I go, and this kind of segues us into, what do you tell a loved one when they don't know what to do, when they've got someone who is self-destructing and just going down that path that you and I are all too familiar with. And the suggestion from Dr. Porges is rather than being confrontational, which absolutely does nothing except maybe you get an immediate response, but it does not create sustainable change. And so what the science suggests is actually creating a safe environment for others and allowing for them to step into that place of change themselves. And the biology behind all of this is that's absolutely the most sustainable way to approach anyone who's struggling with addiction. Create a safe environment for them.
Got it. Create a safe environment for the family or for the addict or both?
Well, you do it for both. I mean, if I'm speaking from the place of a provider or someone who is working with a family, then absolutely you want to create that same safe environment for the loved one, because, they're just in as much crisis as the one who's struggling, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Being able to create a safe environment for them is vitally important. And then when you speak to loved ones, if they're, I've been giving a talk for the last couple of years called What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do. And I systematically take people through a process of how to create that safe environment for your loved ones and for those who are struggling with an addiction. Because, ultimately, it really is the only thing that you can do in that arena where the person addicted is, in a place of survival mode. The best chance you have is to create a safe environment. And here's what's so cool about that. Just like the bull going through the coffee shop, which is going to create a response in you without you even controlling it, the same thing starts to happen when you create a safe environment for them. So when you play on the other end of the spectrum and really laying the groundwork for a safe space for someone, guess what starts to happen? They start to react to that too, even though they may not even know it. They still will react to that.
Sure. Well, and to your point, you know, that's it, you know, where I'm at, where I work at Landmark Recovery, one of the key pieces of what we offer our patients when they come into treatment is our group. And the group is composed of a modality called Seeking Safety. And Seeking Safety is all about creating safety around the patient in the environment so that they can do their work around typically trauma, which is quite often, you know, accompanying addiction. So I think that this is absolutely apropos for, you know, what we're all, you know, trying to do here, which is to give people the space, right? Sometimes a space that they've never been given an opportunity to have because they've grown up in these environments where it's been chaotic. There's intergenerational addiction patterns that have been present that go back, you know, one, two, three, four generations within the family. So I think it's fantastic, man, what you're bringing up. This is great. I did have a question. What is the doctor's? Can you spell out the doctor's last name that you were telling us about?
Yeah, he's a neuroscientist. His name is Dr. Stephen Porges, and it's P as in Paul, O-R-G-E-S, Stephen Porges.
Got it.
And he came out of Chicago. I don't recall where. I know that he's changed universities where he teaches now. He's not at the University of Illinois anymore, but his work is prolific. I'm starting to see it trickle into the addiction recovery space more. It's something that my wife and I have referred to for, gosh, probably the last 7-8 years. And we definitely are starting to see more in the addiction recovery world refer to it, at least for the last couple of years. But it's still new enough that I think many of your listeners are going to want to check it out.
What's James? What's a book that he has written that you would point us toward?
Just polyvagal theory, and polyvagal is a term that refers to that vagus nerve, which is what controls our autonomic nervous system. I don't remember the formal title, but it's right in the book itself is something polyvagal theory. It's his theory. You'll be able to find all of his work just putting in that term.
Very good. Excellent. So, that's a lot and that's good stuff. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself. What is Blue Novus? And can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the company and what its sort of mission is?
Yeah, so we are we see ourselves as a human development company. And the reason that we say is even though we do a lot in training and a lot in the addiction recovery space, at the end of the day, it really is about helping people be better at their jobs, at life, and we have really a couple of different things. Our most deepest value is one that we believe meaningful connection is key. When we are able to connect with ourselves and others around us, we perform better. We are happier. We have more clarity around life. And so connection is, that tends to be across the board, a driver in everything that we do. And we essentially have a couple of different, if you want to call them products or services. One, we work directly with drug and alcohol treatment facilities in admissions and marketing training. So I have the pleasure of getting to work with facilities just like yours all over the country in teaching them some of these concepts on a much deeper level about how you can improve your close rates. Okay. So if you work on the phones for a drug and alcohol treatment facility, I say all the time, we can help you do more with what you're already getting, meaning we can help you connect more effectively with the people that are calling you, whether that's a family member or someone who themselves is struggling with addiction. And we use, you know, it's all steeped in this science that I'm talking about. So that's one thing we call that, you know, that's boosted missions training. Another piece that we have been addressing over the last year is we work with multinational corporations all over the country, and we help those companies address addiction in the workplace more effectively.
Okay.
One of the things that we have seen in just in general is, and, you know, if you've turned on the news or watched any of the reports over the last year, you're keenly aware of the sexual harassment movement and the Me Too movement, right?
Right.
Here's what's so fascinating is that you know, sexual harassment, unfortunately, has been around forever. And yet only in the last couple of years have we really been addressing it in the workplace. And the reason that we're addressing it today is because somebody had the guts and was able to get that new conversation going and open up about sexual harassment. But here's what I find both a little bit scary but also exciting, that nobody's really having the same conversations around addiction in the workplace. And so we created what's called the CARE Initiative, which is Corporate Addiction Recovery Education, where we go in and we educate HR teams in big companies, and then we become a bridge for their employees in how to find the appropriate support and help. And so we're starting a new conversation around that. We've had the opportunity to do a lot of speaking in the human resource space, but that's also one of our bigger initiatives.
Yeah. Oh, that's great, man. That's fantastic. And you guys are penetrating some of the Fortune 500 companies. Is that true?
Yeah. So I tend to not really, I don't name drop.
No, right.
Typically about some of the companies that we work with, we like them to be that voice. We don't try to be that voice. I can share one of them just because they've been very vocal about the kind of work we're doing with them. And some of your listeners might have heard of 1-800-CONTACTS. They're the largest contact lens provider in the world.
Sure.
So they're one of our clients we work with. They've got an amazing culture, but they also have a lot of millennials in their call center, and they wanted to be able to proactively approach how they talk about addiction in the workplace, how they address it in the workplace, and so we've become that bridge or that conduit for them.
That's fantastic, man. So with the training, something like this call center training that you're talking about, when you talk to the folks at the different treatment centers, are you with them for a month, a week, a year, or how long does it depend? And typically, what does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, we have the ability to customize, but we typically have two different tracks, if you will. We have a 4-month, which is a deep dive, where we cover everything from, how to better connect with and build relationships with those who are calling you, the people that you're working with, including referral sources.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot around the power of empathy, deep empathy, the kind of empathy that drives real effective marketing. We do a lot around gaining a better commitment or having a deeper commitment to the work that you're doing and clarifying that.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, so that includes everything from purpose to follow-up to really being, you know, passionate about what you do. And then fourth is around being a better decision-maker and having more clarity and being innovative and coming up with new ideas on how to, you know, how to handle the marketplace. Because as you know, Zach, you know, things are ever changing in our world.
Right.
And
right,
in this industry, I mean, we've got all kinds of moving targets from from Google AdWords and all the changes that have happened online and LegitScript and Facebook, and, you know, how do you handle a changing market? How do you handle, you know, the changes to healthcare and you know, where do you acquire new clients? So that is our deeper dive training. That's typically a 4-month training.
Very briefly for the people that don't know, Google, of course, the big Google, decided about, I think it's probably about 6 months or so ago, decided to essentially eliminate the ads that treatment centers are able to post on their platform. So you cannot, where you used to be able to post an ad somewhere. If someone were to click on it, it would, you know, then take them to their website, and there was what's known as piggybacking on other people's treatment centers. So you would have people who would, you know, compete for the different AdWords, which are, you know, basically what Google uses to sort, you know, when people do searches, to direct them to a particular, you know, site. So if you had, for instance, Landmark Recovery on there, you might have Acme Treatment Center right behind it. And it might even come up as soon as you type in Landmark Recovery and you're able to click on it. And then it might take you to a place, say, for instance, you know, I mean, in Mexico or, you know, in Europe or, you know, some other treatment center in the United States that's 800 miles away from where you live, you know. So Google, I think, has probably, you know, they've wised up and done some of this. But, you know, it's all in an effort to you know, have people advertise on their platform with, you know, integrity. And well, I'll let you chime in too, James, if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I want to, this really started to happen about a year ago. And just to give a little context of what Google did, there's only two other industries that they've ever done this to, from my understanding. I could be wrong, but I know that the porn industry and the cash payday loans industry were the other two industries that they've done this to. So what is that?
Some heady company, huh?
Integrity, a lot of deception, and really the training that we began offering was not a response to this, but just but it certainly reinforced that, you know, we get to be more honest and upfront and empathetic and compassionate and committed to helping people. I mean, I say this quite a bit. You know, most of the people that got into our industry got into it because they wanted to help other people, and somehow, some way, we've lost their soul as an industry. Uh-huh. And I don't know if anyone can really dispute that, because Google shut it down. So the good news is that now through LegitScript, which is basically just a vetting out process, and people can now start to get back on board with advertising and that. But we certainly, you know, it's something that needed to happen. It's an industry that has been riddled with a lot of confusion and deception, and
quite a few charlatans.
I think some great context.
Yeah. There are some charlatans in our industry. There's no question about that. So, as there is in any industry, but I think that there's something particularly distasteful is the word that I would come up with about, you catch someone at their most vulnerable time when, you know, to your point, which you said already, they're not thinking clearly. And there's places that will take advantage of that, and that's just not right. So,
yeah. So I mean, there are some additional hoops for organizations to jump through, but if we're looking at clients and what they're going through, you know, they really deserve to have some transparency to be able to look at what's really out there. What am I really getting for, you know, a lot of money? What am I really getting?
Sure.
And it's definitely an opportunity to set yourself apart, though, too, by by showing up a little bit differently and taking a much higher road. And frankly, I think at the end of those type of practices is a terrific return on investment for people when they do take that higher ground.
Yeah. Good stuff, man. So, you know, I'm looking at our time, and I want to get to some of these other questions about, you know, some of the concepts that you guys implement in your training and your work with other families, people. Tell me about the concept of innate listening, because that's a big piece of what you guys do.
Yeah, thank you. It is. And so innate listening was a term that we started to coin a little over a year ago, even though we've been teaching these concepts for 7 or 8 years. And the reason that we did that is I used to call it deep listening or compassionate listening or empathetic listening. And because those terms most people grasp, a lot of times what we found is people thought they knew what it was. So, you know, I use the term deep listening and people are like, oh, yeah, I totally know what that is. And I'm here to tell you folks that innate listening is next level. It's leveraging that science that I was telling you about with polyvagal theory and really gaining a deep understanding of how can I better connect with somebody through the power of innate listening? How can I create the kind of environment where it evokes from the person I'm communicating with vulnerability, which is that magic place where realness happens and results happen. And so innate listening, the other reason that we decided to call it innate listening is the more that I've come to understand how it really works, the more that I've also come to understand that it's innate in us. It's automatically something we're built with. The problem is that from a very early age, we've been trained to respond rather than just listen. We've been trained to have an answer queued up and ready for the person that we're communicating with. We've been queued up to interrupt. We've been queued up to have an expectation. So innate listening is really washing away all the stuff that we've been trained to do when we communicate with people and really just come from a place that is authentic and patient and just really there to, you know, seeking to understand where the other person is coming from, which, you know, brings in that place of empathy and certainly that place of deep listening. But innate listening, and again, you know, if I refer back to the science totally supports this is a more effective way to communicate with someone. It's a more effective way to understand where they're coming from, which then gives you, more data. You know, if you think of it from an analytical standpoint, the more that I can really understand where you're coming from, how much more effective will my answers and responses be?
Sure. Very effective. Right.
Right.
You know, my question is, you know, I'm digging all this, what you're saying, because it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. My question is, when you have someone who is anxious, right, or maybe it's a group of people or an organization that's very anxious, right, and they want results and they want something quick, do you ever get pushback on this? You know, it just innate listening sounds very therapy-like, you know, and very touchy-feely. Do you ever get pushback on that kind of stuff from those people?
Yeah. Well, I can say this with a lot of confidence. Whenever I've introduced this into one of my speaking engagements, the response is overwhelmingly positive, and here's why. I don't just speak to it. I let people experience it firsthand. And when people feel it, when they feel it for themselves, when they can literally try the shoes on and walk around in them for a minute, the response is always positive. It's always over the top. It's always they want more, they want more, they want more. When I do the training, same thing. Have I had people that have pushed back on it? You bet I have. And what I have typically been able to do is, and ironically, most of the time the pushback comes from those who are in positions of of giving a lot of advice and feedback to people. So ironically, it's from you know, life coaches, therapists, and so. But the good news is that when I start to and go deeper into the science of it, and when I start to show them from experience how this can impact, people tend to open up more to it. So yes, I will get a little bit of pushback, which is very healthy and I think important in that learning process.
Sure.
But it's so steeped in science, and when people practice it and try it on, and that's what I tell people, you know, hey, you don't have to take my word for it at all. If you were just practicing this for yourself and like literally just go try it on in one of your, you know, one of your conversations with somebody and just see what happens. And that's when I get buy-in from people.
Got it. So you probably get feedback like they felt heard, they are more present, they are able to respond versus simply react. They're actually listening maybe for the first time.
yeah, absolutely. All of those. And then going back to that deep driver, that foundational piece of what we're all about, people feel meaningful connection. They feel better. They feel like they can open up. I mean, when someone ultimately feels safe and you donate listening, it evokes that vulnerability piece. It evokes that, oh my gosh, you know what? It feels safe enough for me to actually, you know, share some pretty ugly stuff. You know, yeah. If you're not familiar with Amy Cuddy, and it's spelled C-U, D as in Delta, D as in Delta, Y, she did a pretty well-known TED Talk around body language. But then she, in her book Presence, she talks a lot about, you know, what are the first things that people are asking themselves when they meet you? And number one, and the Gallup, you know, the Gallup polling company substantiates this, but the very first thing they're asking themselves is, can I trust this person?
Sure. That's
and exactly what a right. listening provides is your intent to really try to understand somebody. And of course, if I'm trying to understand you, what's the likelihood that you're going to be feeling that I'm more trusting?
Right. Absolutely, man. And I think that translates, that piece, the trust piece, translates across, you know, basically all relationships. You know, I think that the best therapists that I've ever come across are the ones that simply make it such that it's a conversation, you know, between you and another person, that you're allowing yourself to be open. The therapist is, they're allowing themselves to be open to the experience of this person, bring them whatever sort of toxic information that they have to them, and not judging, you know, and simply noticing and honoring and respecting. And I think that anytime, you know, a person is able to do that, you know, they just, man, it really is a gift that they're giving that other person. And I can see where the training that you guys offer, you know, for people who, you know, answer the phones, even, you know, if they're able to have that empathic sort of understanding of the other person and where they're coming from and really truly listen, you want to talk about your conversion rates going up, they certainly would. And it's not because it's a hard sell that you're making. It's simply because you're taking the time to listen to them.
People do not buy a product because of the product. They buy a product because they trust the person who's selling it to them.
Absolutely.
Right? So what do you, because they don't know if the product is really going to work or not. And if you just take a pragmatic approach to this and you look at it, well, what sells? Like, what are those key indicators that someone is going to buy from you? And again, top of the list, they trust you. They trust you enough that what you just told them is actually true enough that when they purchase that product, or in our case, in this industry, that I'm going to go to a treatment center that's going to help me get better. They're buying from you. They're not buying the product. And so understanding that trust is at the core of why they're going to purchase from you in the first place. And if you think about it, Zach, you know, if you are someone who is struggling with addiction and you're on the phone with somebody at a call center, I see time and time again these call centers talking so much about how great their program is, and, you know, they have all these qualified therapists. But right. You know what? They're on the phone with you. They're not on the phone with your program. They're not on the phone with how nice your facility is. That is not going to invite the kind of response that when you can make them feel important and remind them that they matter,
right?
That is going to be the differentiator. And so I tell people all the time, you are the differentiator, not your program, not your facility. Yes, is it important to be able to relay that information at the appropriate time? Of course. Mm-hmm. But to create the kind of relationship where they choose your facility over the other 15,000 that are in the United States, it's all about what are they going to feel when they're on the phone with you.
Got it. So, as a follow-up question, a family calls in to, let's just say, a call center, right? It doesn't have to be ours. It could be any call center. You know, if you're going in there and you're training these people on the phones, answering these phone calls in these folks' most vulnerable moments, and let's just say that this family member talks to one of these call center representatives for maybe 15, 20 minutes, or, you know, maybe 5, 10 minutes. Anyway, the person, you know, walks away, the family member gets off the phone, walks away, and you know, they're given some information, and it's hopefully helpful. How would someone that you've trained make a follow-up phone call to that family member, let's just say 24 hours, 48 hours later? Or how, you know, what would the time frame be, and what would you tell that person who's in the call center to then ask, you know, or you know, what would the conversation be like as a follow up to that family member?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that we would want to consider is every single one of those conversations is going to be individual and different because, you know, whatever they talked about on, you know, the previous day is going to set up whatever that follow-up call is. The key piece here is to actually follow up. How many times, you know, the call centers where it's just low-hanging fruit, where they're like, I'm just churning and burning, these are, you know, and the typical first question is, what insurance do you have?
Right.
Or how are you going to pay for this? I train teams that's not even a question that actually ought to come up until you've got some key indicators that they're in a ready position to make a decision.
Yeah.
So what I teach is not, I don't give scripts. Scripts in itself becomes robotic. And so I teach people to just become deeply present in the moment and call that person to continue that process of building the relationship, and you're doing that through listening. And then you ask some key questions. Questions like, I mean, how's this for innovative? Hey, how can I help you? Like, what are you going through right now? I mean, just your genuine deep concern will drive the type of questions that will get them talking. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. And, you know, I was just going to say, I mean, it sounds to me like that's how you establish trust, you know, with people who, as particularly, you know, people who have been burned by this disease, who have trust issues, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it comes all the way back to just trust. And so I can tell you this from both personal experience, being a marketing director at a facility and then doing trainings, and also being a business owner for decades, that trust is going to be the ultimate driver. And so the more that you can just establish that relationship, you know, and you may, what you may find out is, you know, at the end of those conversations, they don't have the means or the insurance, but you know what that allows you to do? You know them so well now that you can help them much quicker and become that resource, which falls into, you know, another step is stop trying to fill your beds and start being a resource.
Sure.
The more you make it about them and not you and your goals and your quotas and your beds, the more effective you'll be. in actually filling those and getting more cash pays and getting the kind of results that every facility out there is looking for.
So as we're closing in on time, just had a couple of personal questions for you. You know, what's been the biggest challenge you faced while you began your recovery journey?
Oh my gosh. Well, that's an interesting question. So I went through treatment twice. This year I will turn 50 years old, which if you ask anyone who knows me, I probably act more like I'm in my early 20s.
I met you. You don't.
I was struggling mostly with addiction in my 30s, and I went to treatment twice. I was in and out of the psych ward. I went to more therapy sessions than I can count. But, you know, I'm a huge proponent in this idea of full transformation, that I don't see addiction as a problem. I see it as a really bad solution to an underlying problem, which is why we look at uncovering trauma, right? It's the trauma that then leads to someone trying to fix a feeling. And here's what's so interesting, Zach, with my is, you know, it'll be 11 years in a couple of weeks when I had this transformation. And, you know, my recovery, I don't even focus, frankly, on my recovery. I focus on thriving in my life because I was able to address and really see what was driving my behavior in the first place. And so for the last, 11 years, it's been more about thriving, which, you know, I think is this continuous and positive circle loop of, you know, now I'm all about giving and service and trying to help others,
right,
which then drives me into a better place all the time.
Absolutely.
And so I don't really look at it as I'm not looking over my shoulder wondering if, you know, if I'm going to be at risk. That doesn't even occur to me anymore because I'm just in a place of such positive thriving. Do I have bad days? Absolutely. Do I have days where I'm insecure? You bet I do. Do I have struggles? Do I have challenges? Every single day.
Right.
When it comes to my recovery, it's become so little about that and more about wanting to thrive and really, you know, be the best me I can in this world.
So walk us through, if you would, just the typical day. You know, what does that look like for you? I mean, you know, obviously you don't have to go through every step, but I mean, are there certain key things that you do as almost like a maintenance to keep this, you know, thriving piece going?
Nothing specific. I think I'm certainly driven. I don't feel like I'm 50, even from a business sense. I feel like I'm just getting started again.
Yeah.
I'm one of those weirdos that, you know, I think I was up at 4:30 this morning, my time. And
that was on purpose, right?
You know, I haven't used an alarm in decades. It's just an automatic thing. I do go to bed at a pretty reasonable time, probably earlier than most. And, you know, my day involves some reflection. It revolves building out different talks or content, fine-tuning some of the work that I do, reading books, everything from, you know, leadership development to mindfulness. I mean, it's across the board. I don't think about recovery as something I have to maintain. When you think about transformation, Zach, you know, a caterpillar, when it transforms into a butterfly, doesn't ever think about, you know, if he's ever going to go back or she's going to go back to being a caterpillar. Right. And I believe that we have the ability to transform to a place where recovery just becomes, you know, our part of the story, but it doesn't define anything in our present or future. So I don't spend any time in a maintenance program, if you will, just because it just never occurs to me that I, you know, that's something that that would be beneficial. It's all about progressing.
Good stuff, man. Just real briefly, though, for those who are starting off their journey, as we all did, you know, you and I both, right? We had to start somewhere. What advice do you have for those folks in regards to staying sober and, you know, eventually becoming successful?
The best insight or things that have impacted me not only back then but even today is one, understand your thought feeling relationship and go deeper with that. And what I mean by that is, I can even ask you this directly, Zach. Was there any time where you obsessively used drugs or alcohol where you weren't just trying to fix a feeling?
Never. Absolutely not. Never. Never, ever.
So how important is it to understand?
That's a great question, because it translates today perfectly, because over the holidays, you know, there was, a decent amount of stress, and I found my sugar intake going up.
That is, it's not only the key to recovery, but it's the key to success. It's the key to leadership. It's one, understanding that when we start to use anything to fix a feeling, we have a massive misunderstanding of where our feelings come from, because the assumption is that we are cameras, that we're just walking around in life and we're just taking a snapshot of everything that's out there. And so our assumption is, and we really did this when we used drugs and alcohol, is, you know, we had a certain situation, we were taking a picture of everything that was out there, but the problem is that our feelings never come from anything outside of us. We are not cameras, we're projectors. Here's the problem. The problem is we think we're cameras, which means we have a circumstance that we believe causes stress, and so we try to fix that stress or fix that feeling through drugs, alcohol, sex, work, sugar, whatever.
Right.
And the moment that we can start to see that we're really just projectors, and everything that we're projecting out there is coming from inside of us, all of a sudden it provides us with a deeper understanding of that thought-feeling relationship, which then tells us that we're actually in way more, we have more ability to navigate and understand that our feelings aren't forever. They come and go, just like the ocean, and we can navigate things with a lot more grace once we really understand that we're projectors, not cameras. I would tell people, I think we spend so much time in trying to change our circumstances when our circumstances will never have an impact on what's going on inside of us.
Got it. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation today with James Hadlock. And James, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on to speak with us today. I know that I'm getting the cue from our microphone folks over here that we're just about out of time. So, thank you, man. I really appreciate the conversation today and your expertise and your insight and what you bring to the table in this industry. So I hope you hear that.
Well, thank you. And thanks for having me as a guest. And, you know, if you're interested in any of the work, you can simply go to our website at bluenovus.com, which is BLUNOVUS. And, hope to hear from you. Thank you so much again, Zach. And, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, and thank you for that email address. And before we go, I always end this with saying, if you know someone struggling with an addiction and are searching for answers, please tune into Recovery Radio on Fridays for the most up-to-date information from leading therapists, doctors, and addiction experts like James. You can listen anytime through the Voice America site or iTunes, where you can subscribe, rate, and review any of the Recovery Radio podcasts. And before signing off, I'd like to ask, does someone you love need inpatient or outpatient treatment for addiction? Maybe you or your loved one needs drug and alcohol rehab. Visit LandmarkRecovery.com to learn more about their innovative substance abuse programming that is both saving lives and empowering families. And until next Friday, I'm Zach Crouch with Recovery Radio, wishing you well.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Friday, with all episodes available on demand here on the Voice America Variety Channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.